Exception number 9 to 2, rule number 10.
Mr. George Ray, reel 10. How long were you in England when you got back with frostbite in 1917, Mr. Ray?
Well, let me think now. Say, February, March, April, May, say. I'm trying to... I think I'll be back in France about the June.
Did you make a full recovery from your frostbite?
Absolutely, absolutely. There was no... it was very touch and go that I could possibly lose two or three toes or something of that nature. But apart from that, it was a complete recovery.
Did they give you convalescent leave?
Yes, I had convalescent leave, which was, about 10 days, something like that. Now, when I went back to Blandford, reporting from being on sick, it was getting on into, say, early summer. Say about the latter end of May and June, and... would be in, I'd be in perhaps a couple of weeks or so in the base in Blandford. Now, I was actually in the answering battalion when I left the unit, but we wanted to get back. There were some of us, we preferred to be back in France because we were in our own unit and we rather felt we'd be like to be amongst our pals, so called, you see. So we set off. We had to parade and we were told by the officer in command that he wanted so many volunteers to go. And I, along with several others, even though I was, I had been a signaller, I volunteered, never thinking that it was to we were also changing our battalion. And I changed then to the Hawk Battalion. And off we went. Now when we got, a funny thing happened at Etaps in France. That was the main base, you see. Funny thing happened there. The quartermaster, lieutenant and quartermaster of the unit, base units in Etaps, was, like me, watching a football match. And when he went back to the orderly room, he said to the orderly sergeant, he said, guess who am I seeing today? No. He said, I saw Ray, the man that was Wilson's patron. And the orderly sergeant said, I doubt it, sir. He's not on our roll or whatever. No. Well, the lieutenant said to him, are you seeking to make me out to be a liar? He said, I saw the man there. He said, he saluted. Well, he said, he's not on our in our records. Hmm. Never thinking that I'd changed from the Anson to the Hawk Battalion, you see. So then I was in the Hawk Battalion. I had from that period, say from June, July, August, September, October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, a 12-month run. Actually, It went to June. Absolutely into June. And I had those... at 13 months of being with the battalion up and down the line, up and down the line.
Was the battalion very different from the Anson battalion, or was it very a similar sort of unit?
Similar, quite similar, yes.
You didn't feel out of place? Or
not a bit, no. Because, well, you see, one or two of the men who had been from the base, days of the base, who had been in the Anson, who were transferred to the Hawk, we knew each other to start with, you see.
Now, you say you went up and down the line for 13 months continuous, you know.
Up and down, yes, up and down.
Which main fronts did you visit?
Well, we were at Arras, and then at... I couldn't be quite sure about the order of the service, you know. We were at Arras, we were at Cambrai, we were at Passchendaele. Passchendaele seemed to be the... that was where the... well, the First Army under General... I can't think of his name now. He went to Italy in command of the First Army. Actually, there was this general of the First Army. There were two army generals. There were two generals there who had command of an army corps, the brothers Gough. And we were in General Rawlinson's Third Army for a period. And also, and there was Birdwood's, the Anzac Army. But altogether, there were five or six army corps there, you see.
What can you remember, or what incidents or things can you best remember from that period of in and out of the front line, up and down the front?
Oh, to go back and not to put them in their chronological order, sort of thing, but I recall in the May 19 1917-18. That winter was a very bad winter. Now, we British troops didn't have the cover that the German troops had, for various reasons, I suppose.
You told us that, yes.
I've told you, haven't I? Yeah. Anyway, we didn't have that cover. Where am I now? We didn't have much cover. Well, we're away again now, are we? Anyway, I recall the Christmas because we had been a month, and this was round about, before that took place, I think in 1917, it would be the year that the tanks were first used. I'm a little bit at sea about that, but I'm not quite sure. Because we took over from the Guards. And it was actually... using the tanks was not the success that they expected. And quite a lot of the tanks were put out of action. And some were put out of action, but they were still workable. Because one particular instance, we were next door to the Anzac Division, the New Zealanders, you see. And when we got up under the fire, when you got up under the firing step at night time, we used to do about 2 hours on and four off, or varied according to the number of men that you had in the section, you see. And I remember them saying, well, you can't, you have to, you could look at these tanks at the roundabout over the parapet, and you looked so long until you began thinking that they were on the move. You got that feeling. So anyway, the New Zealanders had a bright idea. In their skirmishing roundabout, they discovered that one of these tanks, they would be able to make it move, because we were in an elevation, and they got this tank, they knew that they could push it, gently ease it away, to run it down into the valley where the Germans were lodged, you see, and they let us know that this was going to happen. It did happen, and they pushed this tank away, and it careered away down, and of course it created such a hullabaloo with the Germans, they didn't know what was hitting them, you see, and the place was really in an uproar. Guns firing right, left and centre, you see, and the least bit excitement or idea that there was anything going to happen, it happened to both sides, you see, that either side didn't matter, they were so, in a sense, tense that anything might happen, you see, that you really went to town on your bombardments and all of this stuff. That was one very interesting feature of the front line. Coming to this Christmas, we were in there. We'd taken over. I think it was then that we took over from an Irish division. And they said they'd had it very, very quiet, which of course they would, because of the 1916 rebellion, you see, and being a Welsh division, you see, an Irish division, sorry. And so we took up in the line, and we were there for about a month. You got accustomed to the hardship of being out, not altogether without cover, because you used to make cover for yourselves, digging around about and so that you could make perhaps a sort of what was termed a cubby hole, so that two, maybe a couple of you could have a sleep there, that kind of thing. But you're all the time you're under this the idea, you know, that you had to be on your guard in case anything happened. And this month, well, we were relieved on the Christmas Eve, and we had to go back to a town called Metz. And it's not the Metz that was in the big city called Metz, but it was on the Rhine, Metz. This wasn't, but this town was. It was about 5 kilometres from the our lines, you see. So we went back, and it was Sunday morning, it was Christmas morning, and going back we were fully expecting that we would be there, you know, for a while, and it would be table, which we did, have our breakfast, and we had to get stuck in. Oh, we had our parcels from home and letters to read and all this. And about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, word came that the Germans had broken the line that we left. They'd broken through the line and had taken some of the men prisoners. And what really made us, the fact that it was Christmas morning and we'd heard these tales about how wonderful it was, this fraternization between the troops. The fraternization, so far as we were concerned, was that these chaps of ours who were, well, not our, not altogether our division, but some other battalion, you see, had come out of their trenches to meet the Germans, because with the snow on the ground, the Germans had dressed themselves up in white smocks. And our people got out of the trench to go to meet them. But these people, it was only a ruse. They fell flat down, and our men were machine gunned. You see, out in the open. Now, whether there were any, well, it gave them the advantage there with the distance, short distances which prevailed. It gave them the advantage so much that they were able to come over and take some of our trenches, you see, that we'd just vacated the night before. Then, of course, as I say, we had to leave everything, get packed up and go back again. So we did just that. And when we got back, of course we lost some of the ground, but we didn't half get a battering, you know, from artillery the next night. They thought, because the Germans expected that there would be a counterattack. And they made up for it. Sad to say, we lost quite a few men. And the sad part about it was, these fellas, like us all, had come up. They brought their parcels with them. And the next morning, after it had broken daylight, and we saw where we were, telephone lines were down. Of course, you always had telephone lines, you know, for your business, you know, contacting this one and the other one. And big blocks of trench, because of the frost, that it was really so hard, just like rock. Big blocks of that had fallen, had been bombed and blasted in, such like, really terrific sight. However, that was one, I shall say.
Where exactly in the line was that? You went back to Metz, but where was it in the line that you'd come from and that you had to go back to? Can you remember?
I thought it was somewhere round about Arras. I think it was somewhere around about that.
Do you have any other incidents or recollections?
I have one. Getting on towards I said that we'd been up. Before ever I ought to say this. I should say that we had a system of Blighty leave. And if your name came up, if you're there with the battalion long enough, and your name came up to the top of the list, then you went to England on fortnight's leave. To Blighty. Mind you, and I was out 13 months, but I'll come to that. You asked me about Passchendaele. Well, looking back, it was very close to the channel, wasn't it? Passchendaele.
Above
Ypres. It was above Ypres. Well, We were in Ypres, or what was Ypres, but it was only for... It was a very short time. It wasn't long enough to get to know very much about Ypres, because we were moved nearer. I've got Dixmude in my mind, but somewhere on about there. But the ground was so level, it's so waterlogged that there was all that water, all that countryside round about there had been flooded because the Belgians had, the Belgians flooded that area, didn't they? Now, we had quite a spell up there. What stands out, we couldn't use the trenches, because if you dug a spade depth down, you came to water. Well, the Germans had pillboxes. And these pillboxes, they were more than pillboxes, it was just like one big block of cement. And I should say that when they built them, they knew what they were being. The shell, a 5.9 German gun, if that hit a direct hit on a pillbox, all that happened was it just shook it. And our people, well, dear things would have with us in many cases. That's why they made them so terrifically strong, you see. Because later on, the Germans used to tell us that we didn't know what it was to be in a barrage. Because we were the people who were supposed to know much more about the barrage than what the Germans did. Be that as it may, we had this period in the, as I say, at Passchendaele, and it was a really very, very sticky job. Any volunteers? We want volunteers to go. Not up the line, we were already up the line. To go to a part of the line where there'd been a battle, and it had been a battle. As you looked over, no trees or vegetation or anything, nothing but a wood, nothing but a waterlogged surface and water and slush in that, and men lying there dead and dying, and the call was for volunteers, stretcher bearers. So it's still said the volunteer was worth 10 two pressed men, or something like that. So anyway, there were six men to a stretcher. So that'll tell you how bad it was. And I was in one of these parties.
You volunteered then?
Oh yeah, yeah. I wouldn't think of anything else, you see. Because they used to call me, I used to be called, among some of the chaps, Lucky Jim, you know, or Lucky Durham. That's because I came from Durham. They'd say, well, there used to be a saying, you know, Lucky Durham, or Lucky Jim. And of course, I did answer to Jim sometimes, you see. And they'd say, Lucky Jim. Because in all the scrapes and the scraps, I used to, well, I don't say this, it was really, it was the grace of God that carried me through. Because I used to get into some awful, well, I used to be in some very predicaments, you see. Anyway, I say after spending this time up in Passchendaele,
you were telling us about when you were a member of a stretcher bearing team, when you volunteered for that.
Oh, that's, yes. Well, that lasted one morning. I know one man we brought out in a whole lot of men whom we thought were dead. And mind you, there'd only been a slight armistice between the Germans and us, only lasting for about an hour to get the men in that we could get in. But there was one fellow had been out there for, must have been there a day and a half. And he was quite conscious. And the first thing he asked for, what do you think? Cigarette. But we had one or two like that. But as I say, with Wellingtons on, it took more than what we could, you know. But really, it was a business. It was really getting those. I don't know how many really were brought back, but it only lasted for about an hour because the Germans got all theirs in. And I suppose we got what we thought was necessary.
But you were exhausted after that.
Yes. Oh, yes. You see, that's...
Did you ever have to do stretcher bearing again, or was this a one-off?
That was a one-off. That was a one-off. I'd like to come now to warmer climes. We came out of the line and it was the autumn of 1917. One of the first things that they taught you in the army was observation, because observation, if you're observant, can save you from a multitude of errors. Now, as we were wending our marching along, right out in the country, I observed the French farmer or farmers, like others, they had pits that they just made, and I was, being a countryman, I had an idea that these pits contained something, you know, of an eatable nature, you see. So we had about a quarter of an hour's march, and as we were walking past this the hedgerows,